Welcome to the deep dive. You know that feeling when you're like digging through your grandparents' attic and you find this old dusty board game,
Oh, yeah, definitely.
right? And you open the box expecting just cardboard and plastic, but instead the pieces are actually warm to the touch.
Which is terrifying.
Exactly. You look closer and the little painted figures are actually breathing, and suddenly you realize, this isn't a game you're holding at all. It's a loaded weapon.
That is the exact reality Tom and his friends are facing today. I mean, they thought they were playing this highly complex, completely original game called Mirari.
Yeah, only to discover they've unwittingly inherited a literally lethal magical legacy from their grandparents.
So today, our mission for this deep dive into the source material is really to unpack how all of this works. We're looking at a story split between two intertwined realities.
Right. You've got the modern world setting where this group of young friends is gearing up to enter this fantasy realm, Mirari.
And at the same time, we're getting this direct feed of a high-stakes Arthurian-style knight's quest happening deep within that very realm.
It's wild. So our goal today is to examine how legacy and, inherited trauma bind these characters across generations.
Right, and we need to explore what happens when the games of our grandparents turn out to be terrifyingly, magically real, complete with these brutal moral tests.
So let's just jump right in. The catalyst for this entire realization is Tom's visit to his grandmother, Clarice Smith.
Yeah, and at first you think he's just going to hear some quaint family history, right?
Exactly, like talking about his grandfather flying that barnstorming plane, Eleanor.
Right.
But then they start talking about old Harcourt Manor, and the floor just completely drops out.
Oh, totally. Grandma Clarice just casually mentions that she and her childhood friends, Anastasia, Bryant, and John, used to play a fantasy game at that exact manor.
And it wasn't just any game, it was a game about a gateway in a mirror leading to a world called Mirari.
I mean, the statistical impossibility of that shared name is what triggers the initial shock for Tom.
Yeah.
But the horror really sets in when you look at the granular details.
The lore is exactly the same.
Exactly. Grandma Clarice tells him she was Lady Therese of February, Anastasia was Lady Angelique, and Bryant was Lord Bram.
They even had the same seasonal houses and the same overarching villain, the Destroyer.
It just completely dismantles the modern kids' understanding of their own agency. They haven't been inventing a world at all.
No, they've just been acting out a script written 60 years ago.
Yeah.
It's honestly like discovering that this highly specific custom tabletop role-playing game that you supposedly invented from scratch with your friends
Yeah.
was actually played move for move by your grandparents, down to the exact inside jokes.
Right, and Grandma Clarice actually has the physical proof to back it up.
Oh, the bronze medal.
Yes, she has this tiny bronze medal of House February just sitting on her mantelpiece.
Which perfectly matches the one Tom's friends found strapped to Anastasia's old teddy bear, Sir Theodore, inside the manor.
And those physical artifacts are so crucial. They serve as tethers between the generations.
Because Grandma Clarice insists this was all just a game of pretend, right? Mimicking old King Arthur story.
She does, but the sheer volume of surviving physical evidence, like, the letter signed by Lord Bram, those bronze medals, it points to something
It's as
else.
tangible.
Exactly. It suggests a mechanism of inherited narrative that goes way beyond childhood imagination. The previous generation poured so much psychological weight into Mirari that it left a permanent imprint.
And when you consider the tragic real-world fates of those original players, it's bleak.
It really is. I mean, John committed suicide after losing the family fortune.
Bryant died in that freak séance accident.
Right, and Anastasia became an actress but died having never returned to her hometown.
So these aren't just sad historical footnotes.
Not at all. They are a massive warning siren. If the modern kids are perfectly mirroring the lore and the alliances of their grandparents' game.
They're on a trajectory to inherit that same trauma.
Precisely. The narrative of Mirari already claimed the lives of the previous generation. Tom and his friends are blindly stepping into a cyclical trap,
They think they're the authors of the story, but the story actually has them entirely by the throat.
which brings us perfectly to how these inherited artifacts are actively functioning in the present day.
Yeah, because we see the modern kids gathering at Harcourt Manor, and the line between a harmless game and objective reality doesn't just blur here.
It shatters completely. You have this really fascinating juxtaposition at the manor.
You mean with the kids plotting?
Yeah, on one hand, you have the intense factional plotting of the teenagers. They're trying to orchestrate a rescue mission for Lord Mel, who is held captive in the West.
But they are operating entirely on paranoia. I mean, Tom is planning to travel with Lord December.
Even though December openly stated that their friend Simon, quote, smelled different.
Right. And meanwhile, Agatha and Alice are planning to travel with Nimue,
a figure who Tom deeply and fundamentally distrusts.
So they're basically acting like political rivals in a Cold War, keeping all these secrets. And hovering around this tense teenage drama, you have a dog named Kuon.
And a horse named Destroy, who is literally a shape changer, casually pantomiming conversations.
Yeah, the presence of Destry alone proves the environment is already saturated with magic.
But the true activation of Harcourt Manor, like the moment it really wakes up, comes down to Alice.
Alice is the youngest, right?
Right. She's completely removed from the factional scheming. And she is the one holding the ancient flute.
The one engraved with a rose and thorns that belonged to Lord Bram and Lady Angelique.
Exactly. Now, the music on that flute is incomplete, but Alice intuitively writes down the missing notes.
She doesn't even study an ancient text to figure it out. She just claims she simply knows how it should sound.
Because she can literally feel Bram and Angelique's old letters through the instrument.
That is wild.
It's sympathetic magic at work. Alice treats the flute as a precious memento, not a weapon. And when she raises that flute to her lips and plays the perfected song,
the response is instantaneous. A chorus of mechanical clicks, that distinct snicked sound, just echoes through the entire manor.
Every single door unlocks. Even Distra the horse's saddlebags spontaneously unbuckle and fall to the grass.
Okay, wait, I have to push back here for a second.
Sure, good.
We keep calling this an inherited narrative or like a psychological echo of the grandparents' trauma. But a psychological echo doesn't literally unbuckle a leather saddlebag, you know?
Right. Right.
A shared imagination doesn't physically manipulate the tumblers inside heavy wooden doors. This crosses a huge line from shared imagination to objective physical magic.
You're hitting on the exact paradox the source material wants you to confront.
Oh, really?
Yeah, the magic is undeniably physically real. But look at how that magic is activated. It completely ignores Tom's tactical planning.
And it ignores Agatha's suspicions.
Exactly. Mm-mm. The manor acts as this massive dormant lock. And the only key that can turn the tumblers is Alice's pure, innocent connection to the music and the history.
So the universe is basically rewarding her lack of a hidden agenda.
Precisely. It's a system that responds exclusively to sincerity. Because look what happens when Tom immediately tries to weaponize it.
Oh, right. He asks Alice to play the song backwards.
Hoping the magic will, like, tie Agatha's shoelaces together so he can win their petty factional feud.
And it does absolutely nothing.
Much to his disappointment. Because the magic of Mirari cannot be used for petty, ego-driven tricks. The failure of the backward song is the universe establishing a firm boundary.
It's such a grounded, funny moment, too, especially when Alice just innocently pivots from unlocking the universe to revealing that she told a girl named Eleanor that Tom has a crush on her.
Yes, and Tom literally panics, falls backward onto the grass, and just declares, "I'm dead."
It's a great reminder that despite dealing with ancient magic, they are ultimately just teenagers dealing with high school embarrassments.
They are. Yeah. But they're preparing to enter a dimension that does not grade on a curve for age. Alice's innocence might act as a skeleton key in the earthly realm, but the story immediately transitions to show us the brutal vetting process required once you actually cross into Mirari.
Which brings us to section 3. And Sir Llefelyn's quest for the Holy Grail.
This is where we get to see the exact kind of high-stakes, rigid moral reality the kids are about to walk into.
Llefelyn is traversing the Haunted Forest, which, as we find out, is actually the Forest of Temptations.
And this forest is basically a sentient psychological meat grinder.
It really is. It's not testing his combat prowess.
No, it's testing his psychological endurance and his restraint. The physical manifestations are tailored to his potential weaknesses.
Like when he sees a beggar drop a pouch of coins, he could just keep the money to fund his quest, but he returns it.
And the beggar explicitly warns him not to stray from the path.
Then the forest escalates. Right off the path, he sees a wooden chest just spilling over with gold.
Ignores it.
He sees a magical sword embedded in a boulder, literally singing with chimes.
He sighs, but he keeps his feet on the path.
But the forest realizes greed isn't going to break this night, right? So it uses something much more insidious.
It weaponizes his affections. Llefelyn smells a campfire and hears a familiar voice. He looks off the path and sees an illusion of his friend, Lord Explorer Thomas.
Who is clearly the Mirari manifestation of the modern world, Tom.
Exactly. And the illusion of Thomas is sitting by the fire, offering food, and actively taunting Llewellyn.
He calls him a coward for rigidly following the rules. But wait, let me ask you, why did the forest choose the illusion of Thomas specifically? Is it just because they're friends, or does it represent a specific flaw in how Llewellyn views heroism?
It is a highly targeted attack. The forest understands that a chest of gold is an obvious trap to a knight, but peer pressure from a respected comrade.
Ah, that's harder to resist.
Exactly. The modern Tom openly admitted earlier that he is a chaotic force who doesn't follow rules.
Mm.
The forest projects that exact chaotic energy to tempt Llewellyn to abandon his discipline.
So it's the ultimate test of restraint, forcing him to prioritize his mission over his ego and his friendships.
And when Llewellyn refuses to step off the path, the illusion just vanishes.
But he maintains his restraint only for the forest to immediately throw a physical threat at him. This terrifying monster, a Nagpla, bursts out of the bushes.
Right, and we know it looks like an absolute nightmare. Llewellyn's immediate instinct is to draw his weapon.
But the underlying mechanics of Mirari require you to look past the surface presentation. The Nagpla doesn't even attack.
It just stands there, drooling and gurgles plaintively. It wants to follow him.
So Llewellyn runs down the path, and this horrifying, undead-looking monster just whines and chases after him like a lost puppy.
And what Llewellyn does next is brilliant. He doesn't slaughter the creature, but he doesn't foolishly embrace it either.
He uses his sword to draw a boundary line in the dirt. He dictates that the monster can follow him, but it has to stay back.
That action reveals the true nature of chivalry within this universe. True chivalry is not mindless violence against ugly things.
It's the establishment of healthy, firm boundaries while maintaining compassion.
By drawing that line, Llewellyn asserts his authority without sacrificing his humanity.
And the universe immediately rewards that. A mysterious bundle drops out of a tree, a Providence sandwich.
Left by angels packed with meat, cheese, crackers, and cookies.
And a lesser knight would totally hoard that miraculous gift. But Llewellyn tosses the meat and cheese to the terrifying Nagpla.
And he shares his last cookie with a random squirrel.
He ensures his providence is distributed, regardless of how frightening or insignificant the creatures appear.
Passing that physical and psychological gauntlet proves his diligence, but navigating the forest only gets him to the destination.
Right, he arrives at Cair Banwaack, this old watchtower, and he meets Pelles of Ann, the Fisher King.
The Keeper of the Grail. And Pelles acknowledges that Llewellyn has passed the tests. But the final lock guarding the Grail isn't a physical key.
No, it's a philosophical puzzle. Pelles looks at Llewellyn and asks one simple question. Are you humble?
Which is just a brilliant trap.
It really is. It operates exactly like a psychological paradox or like a lie detector test.
Oh, totally.
If you sit there and confidently proclaim, yes, I am incredibly humble, the very act of claiming it proves your arrogance.
Exactly. The premise of the question makes a binary yes or no impossible to answer honestly.
And Pelles actually confirms that a simple yes or no would have resulted in Llewellyn being turned into a beast.
The magic of the tower demands nuance. So Llewellyn provides what Pelles calls a crooked answer.
He explains that humbleness isn't a badge you can just pin on your chest. It's a state to be strived for.
He says he cannot definitively say he is humble. He leaves that judgment to God and to others who observe his works.
Which demonstrates a profound understanding of the human ego.
And Pelles accepts this because it is the only intellectually honest answer a mortal can give.
So then we get this wonderfully bizarre ascent to the Grail. The tower stairs are uneven, but Llewellyn is guided by this small cross-eyed cat.
And the cat actually talks to him. It giggles and advises him to get down on his knees and show a little respect when he reaches the top.
The universe is constantly reinforcing this theme of subservience. And when Llewellyn reaches the landing, the visual of the Grail itself completely subverts expectations.
It isn't encrusted with diamonds. It is incredibly simple and unadorned.
He kneels, he prays, and an angel appears to grant him the chalice. But she issues a massive, explicit warning.
She states that the Grail is but a symbol, and it is not to be kept by any one person forever.
It's going to eventually disappear to be found by someone else.
Because the mechanics of power in Mirari are fundamentally tied to temporary stewardship.
Hmm.
The Grail is a tool meant for the needy, echoing what he did with the sandwich and the nag play.
Right.
The moment you try to hoard the magic, you lose the right to wield it.
So when you pull these two halves of the source material together, the synthesis is just incredibly clear.
It really is.
In the real world, the game of Mirari is a legacy passed from Grandma Clarissa's generation down to Tom and Alice. And in the fantasy world, the Grail is a legacy temporarily passed to Sir Llewellyn.
Both narratives show that true power, whether it's the magic of an ancient flute or a holy relic, can only be wielded by those who respect its history.
And crucially, those who lack the ego to claim it as their own.
Absolutely. Alice respects the memory of Lord Bram, so the flute unlocks the physical world. Lefalon respects the temporary nature of the Grail, so the angel trusts him.
It's such a breathtaking structure. We really appreciate you joining us on this deep dive into the source material today.
Yes, thank you.
From a dusty cottage filled with old photographs to the psychological meat grinder of a haunted forest, it is just a brilliant exploration of legacy.
And as you go about your day, I want to leave you with one final thought to mull over.
Okay, let's hear it.
We watched Murari force a seasoned, disciplined knight like Lefalon to run a brutal gauntlet just to prove his purity, right?
Right.
He succeeded, but Pellas made it explicitly clear that failing the test meant being turned into a beast.
The punishment is incredibly severe.
So consider the modern kids. If the magical world of Murari requires such extreme, selfless purity to navigate, what does it mean for Tom, Agatha, and the others?
Oh, wow.
They are heading back into that world armed with teenage egos, factional distrust, and magical flutes.
Are they entering a game, or are they walking directly into a moral crucible they aren't prepared for?
Exactly. What happens when these teenagers inevitably make a mistake? Does the game of Murari demand a much darker, lethal price for those who fail?
Well, when you open that old board game in the attic and the pieces are breathing, you better be absolutely sure you know the rules before you roll the dice.